Welcome to the Compassionate Capitalist Radio Show with host Karen Rands. A compassionate capitalist is someone who invests their money into entrepreneur endeavors to bring innovation to the market and create wealth for all those involved. Karen shares insights and best practices for entrepreneurs to succeed and investors to share in that success without all the risks. And now,
welcome back to the Compassionate Capitalist Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. We're going to have a great conversation today about creating generational wealth. Of course, you know that's a topic near and dear to my heart, by owning and investing in businesses. And what we do a lot when we talk on this podcast and with my guests is, you know, how do you build a successful business? How do you get it to a point that you can create a liquidity event or it's sustainable enough to create that generational wealth, right? And so I have an excellent guest today to talk about this. His name is Arye Scheinbein. He is an expert in this because he himself has been working with numerous Fortune 100 companies, over 20 investment management firms that aggregately have over $1 trillion of assets under management. His background on Wall Street gave him the financial know-how to invest wisely, combined with his direct experience on advising entrepreneurs on starting up and then assisting large businesses with pivots and changes to their major processes. So we know we have a fella that truly knows what it takes to grow a business. And that is what we like to talk about on the show. So stay tuned, listen up. And the other reason why he's the perfect guest, because as a podcast host, I love having other podcast hosts as guests on my show, because we can be some of the luckiest people because we get to have highly engaging conversations with others that do the same thing. We're all experts in our own right and what we do as a career or what we do to make our primary sources of income. But when we have an opportunity as podcast hosts to interview other people that are also experts about their skill sets, their knowledge on what it takes to create sustainable, profitable businesses, investing in those, owning those, exiting those, then we get, it's even better than 6 degrees separation of the golden nuggets of knowledge that you get in that. So we bring so much richness to the table. And Arye is the host of Inside the Lion's Den. It's another of the top 100s on iTunes, where Arye and his guests talk about what it takes to grow a successful business that will last and even become a saleable asset. Sound familiar? Building blocks for generational wealth. And so it's really appropriate as well, given his name is derived from the Hebrew word that means lion. So welcome, Arye. How are you today? Thank you for being a guest on my show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I am well, thanks.
So let's talk about your background. I mean, when we were talking a little bit earlier, you said, you know, you had been, you know, all that experience with Wall Street and working with these various assets under management, but it took a little bit of a turn. So it wasn't just really advising entrepreneurs on the success. It's really seeing the outcome of the actions that they've taken and the value that they've created on that. So talk to our audience about how you gained some of that, gained that knowledge on being able to understand the real internal value of a business before and helping an owner or the executive team make those decisions on what the next step is.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, when you think about, like, let's call it high finance, right? Like Wall Street finance, you have the investment banking world where basically the banks are trying to help these businesses raise money or buy a company or sell a company or divest a part of their company. But most of that happens at a very, very high level, right? Like you're not per se in the weeds as a banker. You understand the triggers and the levels of the levers that move the business at a very high level and what people are willing to pay and what people are, how they're kind of generally valuing them. But when I moved into actually direct investing into these private companies, when I was doing angel investing at a venture firm or the private equity firms, there you're diving much more into the weeds of what are the drivers of the business? What are the motivations of the owners and the entrepreneurs who kind of started it or are trying to grow it? And then personally, in addition to all of that, I was on the side kind of growing my own e-commerce businesses. And I was really getting firsthand understanding of like, okay, I really need to understand my customer. I really need to understand like what, why my customer buys from me besides if it's not going to be price, right? Like I didn't want it to be about price. I wanted to understand like what they were looking for and how I could grow the business personally, whether it was from email marketing before social media, once social media came along, hey, how do you use these tools to kind of grow your business in different ways? What do these platforms actually do or do not do for you? And ultimately, like having these businesses on the side really gave me, in addition to the investing side, but gave me the insight into, okay, if I'm running this or I'm overseeing it from afar or partnering or however I'm doing these different things in my businesses, that gave me different insights. Because I always tell people, like, if you want to learn how something works really well or really want to do something really well, it's okay to watch videos. It's okay to listen to podcasts. It's okay to learn all these things. But when you actually do the thing,
yeah,
you learn at a whole different level, right? And it's just like anything in the world. Like if you want to actually really experience it, it's going to be the actual doing, not just watching, learning, reading type of thing. So the firsthand experience of doing the businesses has also given me like a very different perspective on like how the entrepreneur is thinking about things, how the business owner is thinking of it, not just the financial perspective of, okay, here are the numbers. What does the storyline of the numbers tell me, which is what my professional training does. But it also says, okay, what's psychologically a little bit and what, you know, emotionally a little bit is going through the business owner and how are they going to manage through some of these things?
Okay. So when, let's talk a little bit about valuations, kind of like get to the end and then we'll come back to the beginning since we're sort of sure. There, you know, what did, like, what have you seen change over time in just like say the last decade and you know, where we are today on the things that, you know, cause obviously, you know, the financials, EBITDA, those kind of things, there's hard assets. Are there intangible things or aspects to a business that you've seen start to add value? Like, and let me give you a sort of in a context of something, because when it comes to evaluating startups and companies and you're like, oh, they're a unicorn cause they've got this, you know, $1 billion valuation. We never thought we'd see a $1 billion company until you put $500 million into them and then they became a $1 billion company, right? And so, you know, and you're like, well, they don't have any revenue. How can they be that? Oh, it's the eyeballs, you know, those kind of things, right? So talk a little bit about some of those intangibles that we see out there that impact, you know, one world of valuations versus the world of private equity funds and actual acquirers and how they do valuations.
Yes. It's actually, it's funny. Some of the things you said are like, I have like a million examples, right? And some of them are like, there's a lot of opinions floating around my head really quickly. So, you know, I kind of separate the two worlds almost like old school private equity, right? Like if you think about old school private equity, what, if you read about the 80s and even in the early 90s, right? Leverage buyouts was what a private equity firm would really do, right? So what would they do? They would take a business, they would layer on a ton of debt and they would put a little bit of equity in and they would basically operate on enough thin enough margins that if they could pay that, make that interest payment on the debt, then they could operate the business and kind of grow it that way, right?
Sure.
And they would take money out in different ways all along the way. And ultimately, like a lot of the general cycles of the markets and the businesses crash a lot of businesses, right? Like if we go back to 2008, where yes, you had all the real estate related things, but if you look at some of the deals, actually business deals, not real estate deals, but some of the hung deals is what we would call it. Like a deal that a transaction that was supposed to Tyco, right? $30 billion right. Or whatever it is, right? Right. You know, Deutsche Bank and Citigroup and all these guys had billions upon billions of dollars of debt that they had underwritten. And a lot of it was still on their balance sheets at the time. And nobody wanted that paper, meaning nobody wanted the debt behind it because the company was too levered.
Right.
And they were dumping this stuff 80 cents on the dollar, 70 cents on the dollar, 60 cents on the dollar. And if you actually believed in the business enough, you could go in, restructure, or just hold the note. And that's like what distressed debt people were doing back then. So old school private equity, they're looking for traditional businesses that, you know, in the historical fashion, they were like pay 7 to 8 times EBITDA and see how much debt the business could hold on it. And then say, okay, how can we make this better? where can we cut out the costs, strip it down, make it a little bit shinier, and then sell it to the next person for 7, 8, 9 times, or attach a bolt on of some sort of growth story, right? Quote unquote. And okay, now we can get an 11 multiple. Right. Versus the venture world where, you know, unicorns are no longer unicorns. We're looking for the decacorns, right?
Yeah.
The $10 billion company now, right? And it's happening. But if you look at, okay, so if we're going back to the question of like, what are some of the things we value? What are some of the things we look at versus like intangibles and things like that? I would say like the last 10 years has been completely transformative from a valuation standpoint, both buying businesses, selling businesses. If you think 10 years ago, there was, if someone said to you, yeah, my company is a DTC, direct to consumer, right? That's what DTC stands for. That phrase didn't exist.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you went to Procter & Gamble 10 years ago and said, you're going to be competing with brands that are selling direct to the customer on the web, they'd be like, yeah. Like, okay, I'm not really worried. I spend, you know, $50 million a month on TV ads. I own the customer, right? Whereas now the tables are turned, right? And you saw a couple of years ago, Kellogg goes and buys this little company, RX Bars, for $600 million. Unilever buys Native deodorant for $100 million. Like, what's happening? What's happening is companies can move way faster than the big guys. Mm-hmm. They can get into the exact vertical niche of the specific customer, the avatar they are talking to, way faster than any of the big guys can. They don't need to spend all the dollars that Procter & Gamble used to spend to get the crest and the, you know, and bounty and all these things in your brain that you need to buy Tide, right? It's much more like, hey, what's the impact on the environment? How does this help me anyway? Like all these different things, right? Like I'm focused on the customer and I get the customer attached to me really, really quickly. Those brands are getting sold at, you know, good valuations, quick turnarounds that they're able to, some people are getting in and out of businesses in 3-5 years, which would be like the most unheard of thing in the past, right? So, industry is shifting really, really quickly. I mean, I would say like the last 2 years, obviously because of COVID, online shopping has changed tremendously. Like at the end of 2020, Shopify, which again, company that probably really wasn't like known 10 years ago, which now is, you know, a massive company. Shopify said on their Q4 earnings call last year, they said that 2020 basically jumped 10 years. What they were expecting numbers wise in 2030, they saw in 2020.
Oh yeah.
And so transformation is massive, right? Adoption where people who were in their 60s and 70s would never really feel comfortable shopping online. Now it's just click, 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 deliver it to my door. Like, why do I want to go out to call it the grocery store or wherever, right? So I think a lot has changed. One of the big things in tangibles is if you have a customer list, right? That is something super valuable in the sense that, like, think about, again, 10 years ago, did Procter & Gamble know who their customer was?
Right, no. Exactly.
Everybody was their customer, right? Like everybody who wanted laundry detergent and napkins and toothpaste and all these things. Whereas now, you know, think about a company that just went public in the last couple of months, Allbirds, right? So Allbirds, the shoe company, right? These guys went public. They knew who their avatar was. They knew who their customer was. They had the list. They could do different things. Now the stock has actually performed pretty okay in a tough market. Like this has been a rough, you know, I don't know, call it 3 or 4 weeks or so for some of these companies. But even Sweetgreen, another like a niche, you know, health company that went public in the last couple of months or whatever it was. These are brands that are dialed into the customer and they own the customer list. They have ways to immediately communicate with the customer, get repeat sales without spending more on ads. So it comes down to, hey, do you know the lifetime value of that customer? Yes. Okay. Now, how much can I spend to acquire that customer? And once I could do that, most of the bigger companies can't move that speed. And the valuation on those things are tremendously more valuable than a company that's just like, hey, every year we sell X number of widgets and we just have to grow by selling more widgets. The other thing that probably, again, 10 years ago, recurring revenue, another big valuation driver, like when you're selling a business. Old school private equity, that wasn't like necessarily, it wasn't a negative, but it wasn't something everybody looked for. Now, you know, it used to be like, hey, how much revenue is under contract? and how many years of the contract, right? Like, so if you have a contract with the government, if you have a contract with like a big Fortune 100 company, and how stable is that? What percentage of your revenue comes from that contract? Those were good thing, pros and cons that people looked at when buying. Now it's like, okay, how much of that business is recurring? Do you have it on subscription? Do you have it on a is it a software model where it's recurring revenue monthly? Is it recurring annual? Like, what does that look like? And the recurring revenue is like, I wouldn't say it's like the be all and end all, but it drives valuation higher because I can start day one of next year where I left off day 365 last year, right? Versus one-off sale. So these are just some of like the intangibles and big changes that have happened in the last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, that I think that has contributed to, because it would have been in the past, for a company to go public, one, they have to be really big, a name brand kind of a thing, and of late, really technologies a lot of times, right? Whereas you just named two consumer product companies that went public instead of being acquired by and being folded up inside another computer consumer products company. So do you see that, because that it's sort of this hybrid of the traditional metrics of what creates market value in the market, so that the public stock investors won't just be hyped like we were like with Snapchat or something like that, right? They actually can look at it and see those tangible things that you describe, and it becomes viable for companies to do a public offering as an exit rather than selling the company.
So it's interesting because, you know, depending on how you think about it, we clearly are at very high valuations, right? We are at all-time highs in the market. So me saying that high valuations is not anything controversial, it's factual.
Yeah.
the question becomes like, will we maintain those levels of, you know, valuations where companies, you know, if you look at crypto companies or if you looked at software companies, there are companies that are trading at 80 times forward revenue, right? I mean, ridiculous numbers here. And, you know, 10 years ago, nobody ever would have done that. Even in the dot-com boom, when we were talking about eyeballs, there was no profit. So what are you trading on revenue? Like, these revenue multiples are higher than those. Like, there's no question about them. So in terms of like viability to go public, it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next few years. I think like everything else, technology has changed a lot of things. And one of the things it has changed, I believe, is the speed of acceptance and speed of dips, you know, pullbacks in the market and things of that nature. So if we go back to the beginning of COVID, right, March of 2020, the market crashed, whatever, 30%, 40% in that, you know, first 3 weeks. But then we saw like a crazy bounce off the bottom, and we more or less haven't looked back. Right. And we saw a real V shape, which if you go back to any of the prior cycles, you know, typically it was like a 7 to 9 year cycle of a market. We were in what, year 13 of a bull market.
Yeah.
But if you actually start to like pull apart, you'll see like last year we had that big dip. We've had some pullbacks here, 10, 20%, but they're like almost like 2 weeks. They don't last very long. So I struggle with figuring out like, okay, how are people going to view things like these consumer product companies when they're public? Because there's a huge difference between being a profitable private company and a publicly filing company. And the reason I say that is like, forget the compliance cost, okay? Forget the cost of being public, because that's one thing I think a lot of people just generally don't think about, especially with SPACs, right? Like, now they're just like stuffing these companies into these things. But the other thing is like, what happens once you go public? The shift goes from growth and great story to managing Wall Street and investor expectations. And so I think it depends on the investor base of the stocks. And that's another thing that the last 2 years have shifted tremendously with Robinhood, with Webull, with Public, all these, you know, app trading apps, where now there's zero trading costs, right? Everybody's removed all the fees. Retail investors have like a totally different appetite than the old school institutional investor. And yeah, you need the institutional investor to kind of get a lot of these companies out into the public markets. But at the same time, there's just like an insatiable amount of retail capital right now. And, you know, the Reddit, the AMCs and the GameStops of the world have proven that retail investors can band together and carry a lot of clout. And that can carry some of these brands. If there's tremendous attachment to them, people can carry them. At the same time, you're seeing like this earnings season has been a very, Q3 earnings has been really, really interesting. If you look at like what's happened, like Zillow and Peloton and all these hot names that have kind of stumbled and bumbled because guidance was this way or, you know, expectations was this way. It's going to be interesting to see how a lot of this evolves. And if I had a crystal ball, I would give everybody the answer, but I don't know the answer.
Yeah. That was a long way around not knowing the answer, but you did give lots of good information there, and that's what we want, right? So
yeah,
let's sort of shift over to this idea, because with this, you know, we're with this aging demographic that we just have in our population, as well as a lot more flexibility with types of income that can be created, where you can work, a lot more options, a lot more, I guess, removal of fear of taking a chance. Sometimes, you know, surviving a pandemic will help you say, you know, I've always wanted to, or this or that or the other. You know, and one thing that I know that folks my age, particularly in the corporate world, go through is, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, right? You got that little entrepreneur bug up inside of you, and you hate your job, you hate your boss, you feel like you're not contributing, you're whatever. You know, it's like for a while there, before I wrote my book or rewrote the book, I was, it seemed like every month there was a new article about kind of like the new 50 is 60 or this or that. So the new midlife crisis was go start a business. And so leave your corporate gig. You don't need to get that fancy car or have an affair, just go become an entrepreneur. And so it's like, I know you work with a lot of folks talking about, you know, creating wealth over the long haul. And one in particular topic that we talked about earlier is starting versus buying a business, different strokes for different folks. And of course, my perspective is, you know, keep the best, have your cake and eat it too. Keep that well-paying job with the benefits and all the perks that you get for, you know, having to actually only work 30 hours a week to get paid for 50 hours, you know. And I'm say that in joke. My husband works 70 hours of work and gets paid for 50 hours, but entrepreneurs work 70 hours a week and maybe get paid for 25, you know, just sort of depends on where they are. Right. But anyway, so let's talk about that. Like, how do you help the folks that are in that point in their life make a decision emotionally, financially? Do they start? Do they buy? What do they do when they're trying to maximize, because, you know, saving, nobody ever got wealthy saving money. You have to make money compound in some way with an investment that's giving you more than the 2 or 3% you might get, right? So how do you put your money to work to make it work for you? And I have a prejudice that says it's in entrepreneurism, but I also recognize not everybody is wired to be an entrepreneur. Like, my husband's not wired to be that. So talk to our audience about that, because I know you have a lot of insights and thoughts on this topic.
Sure. So I agree in the sense that fundamentally, right, like wealth creation, one of the best ways to do it is through business that becomes more valuable, right? Having a business that becomes more valuable. That, though, does not come with risk, without risk, right? Like, it comes with some risk. And if we think back 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, but definitely 20 years ago, where anyone who's in a big corporate job today, the idea of being an entrepreneur wasn't like, I don't even think if you said that word to someone, they would know what that even like, it wasn't a vocabulary word that was like constant, right? Like, okay, where now it's a normalized thing, right? It's one of the career paths. Like, every school's got an entrepreneurial like program, right?
Very true.
And so it was like this big, scary thing to say, I'm going to go work for myself, right? Like, they'd be like, oh, are you going to open a laundromat or are you going to have a pizza shop? Like, what are you going to do, right? Whereas now, you literally, if you have a phone, which is basically a computer that fits in your pocket, you can run a business of some sort, right? Like the gig economy or not, social media, all these different things. There's so many ways to make money, right? And so if you're in a job that you hate, I definitely agree that, like, before you take that leap, have your ducks in a row and potentially start it while you're still in your job, right? Like, now I'm not saying do it during your job hours, right?
Right,
like
I'm
telling you, like, at night, learn the skill or leverage the skill that you already have from your X number of years in your corporate job to get into this. But you, the first thing is you have to really know your risk tolerance, your personal profile of, like, do you like the idea of more money or do you like the idea of actually, like, running a business and doing different things that are scary that, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? So there's a lot of stuff hiding behind that wall that you don't know is waiting for you, right?
Right.
And so, like, how do you feel about that? How are you going to react to that? And if that's you, and if you love that, okay, then you know this is kind of like the path for you. If not, you can be an investor in these businesses without actually leaving your job. But if you are miserable and you hate your job, I say, okay, you probably need a new job. Like, if you want to stay in a job or you don't want to start your own business, you probably need a new job if you actually really hate your job. And like, legit, there's a lot of people out there who just hate their job. Like, there's really are, and it's sad. And I'm not going to tell you, oh, go follow your passion and the money will come. That may work, but, like, that's not going to be my number one piece of advice, you know? So that, in the sense of, okay, if we're going to build a business, should we build it from scratch? Or are we going to go take a job somewhere? Or are we going to partner up with someone? Or are we going to go look at an existing business that could maybe use our skill set or maybe use some of our money? Like, there's so many different options. Don't feel like there's only one thing, right? Because you read the magazine that talks about all these, you know, graduates from MIT or, you know, wherever, and they've gone and started all these software companies and now they're all billionaires and you feel left out. Don't think that that's the only way, right? Like,
right.
There's a lot of what I call boring, successful businesses. There's a lot of other businesses that don't have to be, you know, technically driven. So there's a lot of opportunity out there. And I think part of this whole quote unquote entrepreneurial journey is really learning about yourself, what you really are good at, what you really don't like, and not pretending that you're going to like something. You know, you don't like it, but pretending you're going to like it because you're not. So if you're leaving a job that you don't like, going to something you don't like is not a great strategy either. So really understanding, like, what your drivers are, right? Like, if you're at a point in your life, you're like, hey, this job, I don't really love my job, but I have money, I have a good lifestyle, I have my family, I'm doing the things, then the idea is now that money, like you said, has to be compounded, right? Like, real wealth comes from money growing, whether it comes from money growing in the stock market, whether it comes from real estate, or whether it comes from investing in your or other people's businesses. It is money making more money, right? So deploying the money to make more money. So if you're going to invest in a business, right, I would always advise people, like, if you are think you're going to be passive in some other person's business, you either better really know, like, and trust the people who you're giving that money to.
Right.
Or you better really know that business inside and out. And then it really isn't so passive anymore. Right. And so there's lots of different ways, you know, you and I spoke before about different ways you can kind of test the waters and kind of get a sense of how you feel about that business or how you feel about those people. Because, you know, I don't know if the exact quote, but I'm pretty sure if you look at some of the things Warren Buffett has said, and that is, you can take an okay business and put an amazing management team in and you're going to do well. But you can have an amazing business idea and poor management and you're probably going to lose.
Right.
Right. So people are a huge part of business. No matter how you slice and dice it, people drive business. And so understanding who you're getting into bed, so to speak, with, right? Like, who you're investing with, who you're partnering with, who you're working with is very critical to whatever you want to be doing next.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when investors that are part of my National Network of Angel Investors come to me because they are usually they're busy executives that have made the decision that they'd rather keep the security than you know, go start a business or, you know, something like that. But they want that. They've reached, I mean, usually for me, the asset class of investing in entrepreneurs as an angel investor or however you just think is sort of like the third asset class, right? You've already figured out how to read a stock, you know, read the financial performers and all of the analytics for stock markets, cut mm-hmm. your teeth there, then real estate, and you get help with real estate. You don't just go out and buy a house because it, or a property because it looks nice and it's got good bushes. You have experts that help you decide if it's got good bones and does it have, you know, what's the analysis of the income that's going to be produced from that. So similarly, you can have that same sort of structure and stability and discipline when it comes to investing in entrepreneurs once you understand that process, right?
And so agreed.
And a big part of it, I think sometimes a lot of times investors and angel investor groups fail to recognize is the skill set it takes for somebody to start a business and that hunger and that vision and then all that kind of stuff is different than the skill set it takes for somebody to turn it into a company that builds teams and grows and has processes and organizational structure and, you know, these all these moving parts. And so depending on your stage, if you've got business acumen, then you can look at it based on your own experience to say, well, that entrepreneur. And so this is one of the things I do with investors. It's like, if you really like that business, because that thing is really great, well, then you make sure that part of their use of funds is a business coach or a profit coach or somebody that's going to help that entrepreneur get through to that next phase. So you don't have to babysit the business yourself. You can, but you know that there's these pieces of parts. And sometimes I think people just sort of take it at face value and they're like, oh, this is exciting. And they invest on emotion. And that's one of the reasons why investing in entrepreneurs gets dinged so many times, because it can be so highly risky when emotions are involved. Right. And I think the other asset classes are not near as emotional. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's, in every asset class, there's FOMO, right? So fear of missing out, right? So the emotion drives, you know, your next door neighbor is telling you about crypto. Your other next door neighbor says that they just did an angel deal and they 100x. Your dentist is, while you're getting your teeth worked on, he's telling you how he bought, you know, Snowflake IPO, and now he's, you know, going to take a month off, whatever it is. So everybody's always got like the story that kind of gives them the FOMO. So the real thing with these angel deals is exactly some of the things that you outlined. And that is like understanding, like, most of the businesses that kind of start, it's very rare. Like Mark Zuckerberg is one of these rare CEO founders that is still CEO. For Jeff Bezos, rare founder to CEO, right? And stayed on for so long. Most of the time, the person who got them here is not going to get them there, right? It's right. Because doing more of the same thing typically doesn't get you there, right? Like, you need new skill sets, you need team building, you need lots of different things. And it's not a knock on that person. Some people evolve and learn it and great. And to your point, like, they'll need some sort of mentoring / coaching, right? And so that's, some VCs are known for that, right? Like, sure, they come with a checkbook, but they also come with guidance. They come with strategic advisory. Other times it's the angels who, in the beginning, they're willing to step in and say, I really want you to be successful. Here's money, but also maybe here's some advice. Then there's just general advisory boards where sometimes you're giving up some equity for mentorship of some sort of kind. And so it could be a paid coaching mechanism too, right? Like, there's a lot of executive coaches out there who, this is what they do. They kind of, you know, there's the sound business knowledge, but there's also like a lot of mental fortitude required, right? There's not just the grit, but just like how I get through this kind of stuff. Like, mentally, am I going to make it through this stuff? So who you back and how you back them, like I said, people, super important. But also knowing that, like, if you just think it's like a set it and forget it, you know, like, people joke about angel investing, right? It's the spray and pray hope, you know, like, you know, we throw a bunch of money around and like we spray it out and then we pray that one of them hits, right? But if you're going to be, and it also depends on like check size you're going to write, right? Like,
right.
You can write $1,000 angel checks, but you also, if you're going to be like a real angel in the sense that like you're coming to you, not coming to a syndicate, you're talking $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 checks. you better believe in this business and these people, unless, you know, that doesn't impact your bottom line, fine, but you still want to really believe in this and understand that business. So there's very little in the sense of like, hey, let's be passive when you're writing a super large check to a business. And so like, if you're going to maintain your job and you're like, hey, I want my wealth to my next level of wealth to come from business ownership, then you're going to have to be a little bit more picky and do a lot more due diligence. But if you're going to spray it around or you're going to be doing like little bits and pieces, in theory, like you don't need as much diligence on some of the stuff. You're going to have hits, you're going to have strikeouts, you're going to have home runs, you know?
Yeah.
So it really depends on you and what your objective is with this asset class, right? And like you said, like this is one of like what I would view as like the four pillar, key asset classes.
Yeah. So everybody that's listening out there, you want to connect up with REA, please go to solutionadvisory.com, just like it's spelled or sounds, SolutionAdvisory.com. For REA Scheinbein. So you got time for one more question? I want to pick your brain a little bit more if you got the time.
All right, let's do one more.
All right. So this is all about the liquidity piece. And I think it's not only for the business owners, right? But then also for the investors that are investing. If they're an angel that got in early on that first seed round and they haven't really gotten to another round, or it's a family-owned business that's got a second generation and they need, talk about some of the creative ways that people, business owners, those founders, and even within the investors can create liquidity without selling the entire business or doing a whole going public process, that there's baby steps there's first steps, if you will, or half steps along the way that you can get some return on your investment without having to go full throttle.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So as you mentioned, right, like the natural exits are selling your company entirely or taking it public. And now you have big, big, big liquidity events, but a lot of companies never get to that point. And so we've got all this wealth tied up in our number one asset, right? Like if we're a business owner, yeah, maybe we had a job, maybe we still have a job, whatever it is, but like, we probably don't. Like now, if we are a business owner, a family, all these things you said, or even an angel investor, we have all this money tied up in this company. How are we going to access this and actually give ourselves some liquidity? Because like, it's good, but like, unless we don't want to sell it yet, we feel like there's more growth, or we don't actually want to sell it for a million different reasons. So what are we going to do? So one of the things, if we go back to the early discussion on private equity, right? Like one of the playbooks that a lot of private equity firms use, in that small businesses or big business, no matter how big the business is, can do. And especially when you're a non-public company, right? Specifically when you're a private company, one of the ways to take money out of the business, i.e. give yourself some of the liquidity events, is what we would call like a dividend recap. So the dividend is just like if you are a shareholder of Johnson & Johnson and Coca-Cola, right? What do they do every year? They take some of the profits and they pay it out to shareholders in the form of dividends. Now, when you do that, how big is that of the amount of profits, right? Like most of the time you need the money to be reinvested into the business, or you need capital to grow, or whatever it is. So the dividends are usually not massive components of the business. So if we take a smaller company, they may not have a ton of money to give in cash flow dividends. So how are we going to do this? So a dividend recap means we're going to recapitalize the business, meaning we're going to take in the money in the form of debt. We're going to go to a bank, okay? And we're going to take a loan. Now, again, we're not talking about personal debt, but we're talking about the business debt. Now, most businesses need some sort of capital to grow, and business debt is not a bad thing, especially like in this rate environment. If you could be borrowing at 3% and you know that your business can throw off 20% on every dollar that you spend, that's a pretty good return, right? Like you're paying 3, you're getting 20. It's a good trade. And if you get a better return, even more. So you can take in though capital from the bank, and it's not like you're hiding this. They're going to say, what's the source? Is it here? The source is the bank. What are the uses? What are you going to use this money for? Right. And you could be like, oh, we're going to grow. We're going to this, we're going to that. One of the things is like, hey, we're going to do a dividend recapitalization, meaning we are going to give money to our shareholders. So think of it, the easiest way to explain this is like, think of your home. So you have your home value is $1 million, and you have a loan you went and you went pretty levered and you took an $800,000 mortgage. Okay, so you out of the gate, you put $200,000 down and the bank gave you $800,000 in value. Fast forward a couple of years and the home is now worth $2 million. Okay, so what's happened is hopefully the loan has kind of been paid down a little bit. So it's less than 800, but let's just keep it at 800 for simple math. Your equity, the value between the value of the home and less the debt owed is what we call the equity. So the equity at the time of the purchase was $200,000, but now the equity is $1,200,000, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to tap into that. It's the same with the bit. So what would you do? You go to the bank, you'd like refinance your debt, right? So you go to them and you're like, hey, give me a new $800,000 loan, or no, give me a new, you know, $1.5 million loan or whatever it is, right? Because the bank is happy to lend against the $2 million asset. And so they say, okay, the home's worth $2 million. We'll lend you $1 million. We'll lend you $1.5 million, whatever that number is. It's going to be more than the 800. And so now you get to take money and put it into your personal bank account. Yes, you owe it. The home, though, is more valuable than the loan. But you now can take that money and do whatever you want with it. You could buy a business. You can invest in a business. You can put it into another real estate, whatever you want. But now you have the cash, right? It's not tied up in the home. The same with the business. You go, you have a business, and you're like, okay, we've got this business, and here it's worth $5 million. And the bank says, okay, you know, we'll easily lend you $2 million. Well, okay, amazing. We can service the debt at $2 million based on the cash flow of our business. And now we can do what we want with this business, with this loan. So let's say we want to keep $200,000 in there as a reserve, capital or expenditures, whatever it may be. But now we have $1.8 million that we can give to shareholders, to investors. And you're not no longer owning the company. We haven't sold the company, but we're actually getting money off the table. We're taking money out of the value of the business, just like we did in the home example. We're doing the exact same thing in a business. So that's one way we could do it. Another way in today's market, when companies raise capital, right? So they start raising and the company's worth $10 million and they go to the next raise and it's worth $50 million. And the company that raises is $100 million. It's all very nice on paper, but you know, you're 5 years in and the company's gone from a $10 million valuation to call it a $500 million valuation. Well, now the company is starting to like have legs and traction. But the early employees and the CEO and the founder and all these people, they got, you know, shares, they got paper value going on here, but that won't buy them the next house, right?
Right.
That won't pay for their vacation. They won't get to send their kids to private schools until there's some kind of liquidity. So what's happened a lot is in these markets is when they do that next raise, they'll say, okay, we're going to raise, call it $50 million at $600 million, right? Because we were just at the $500 million. The next raise, we're going to raise some money at a set valuation. And when we do that, right, we sell a portion of the company. But we're also, in addition to that, we're going to open up a separate bucket that allows anybody who's been invested, let's say, you know, 3 years ago or earlier, so years 3, 4, and 5, if you've been in this company, you can sell 20% of your shares to investors at the same value. So for them, they don't care if they're buying it, you know, at a $600 million valuation today, or they're buying your old shares, so because it's all worth the same. We've established that the business is worth $600 million. For you, for the founder, for the employees, for whatever it is, you've got these shares. You can't do anything with it yet. Maybe the company becomes worth $6 billion, so it's another 10x from here, but you are willing to take some liquidity because you've been riding this till now. So a lot of these raises get done with like an additional bucket. So the company is not selling that ownership, but rather you are selling part of what you personally own as an owner, as an investor and stuff like that. And you know, there's also just evolving markets here for these secondary trades that where people can sell their shares. Reg A has different, you know, fundraising things. If you see like Republic has all this kind of different stuff. So all different things happening, but these are probably like a bunch of good examples that hopefully, you know, people can take away and maybe use one of these for their business.
Absolutely. And it's really exciting to hear that, you know, the traditional sort of financing, venture financing, you know, has had that level of recognizing that tapped value or that untapped value, because so many times they're like, well, you know, the whole anti-dilution provisions and like that, but they're willing to, to benefit the original founders and those early, you know, serial number stockholders. And then, you know, similar to what we have seen come out of the secondary markets with the Reg A+. But, you know, because before, it seemed like private equity funds were the only ones where founders could get, along with the company getting money to grow to the next level, could also exit some of their shares, and they might, and the private equity fund would be a minority shareholder, you know, kind of a thing. And then you'd have another round, and then they would sell it all, but you know, they wouldn't actually exit and sell the entire company. And so I think, you know, that's the thing about money. Money is smart, and money usually, I believe, as an entity of our world, tries to find a way to duplicate itself and make more money. Money just likes to make more money. And so many of those folks that kind of drive the different financial vehicles and trends and things like that, ultimately they wanted to be competitive in the way that they make money. So you have to have all these options for that intrinsic pent up value in these private companies to be able to find a way so that entrepreneurism continues to thrive and investors continue to take their money and put it into the next thing that they want to be a part of. So
for sure.
Thank you so much, RA, for joining me today. Again, I want to remind folks to go and connect up with RA at solutionadvisory.com. And anything else you want to say before we wrap up here that you didn't have an opportunity to share? Or
no, this was great. I hope everybody gained tremendous value out of our conversation and really enjoyed it.
Yes, I think so. I think we hit all the right spots that we needed to help, which is in our joint mission, if you will, to help people understand how to create wealth through being smart with what they do with their money and in the way businesses and business owners can create more value for themselves personally and for their business as they grow those into sustainable, profitable businesses. So with that, I want to also encourage people to go to KarenRands.co and you can get information there about the services that we offer. And also, if you haven't yet purchased Inside Secrets to Angel Investing, there's links there to get it. Or go to InsideSecretsToAngelInvesting.com so you can learn for yourself, should you, would you, could you be an investor in private companies? And if so, how to go about doing that without all the emotion, right? So with that, onwards and upwards. Thank you again, RA, and have a great day.
You too. Thanks so much.